From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, March 16th, 2017. And on this day, Governor Paul LePage's proposed budget cuts roughly $40 million for local school districts to help pay administrators. We'll look at how that would affect those districts, and we'll continue our series on aging in Maine. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
We are hearing today a lot about President Donald Trump's proposed budget, and we will be hearing a lot more in the coming days. We will mention here one impact that would be felt particularly by those of us in coastal states. The 50-year-old Sea Grant program would lose all of its federal funding under the president's budget. Of the $250 million in cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the single biggest would be the entire $73 million that typically funds the Sea Grant program at 33 colleges, including the University of Maine.
The really important thing from our perspective is to make sure that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Heather Deese with the Island Institute says it is understandable that the administration wants to save money, but she says important programs that contribute to the health of coastal areas should be left alone.
The Sea Grant funding is absolutely one of those critical funding programs.
Similar to Cooperative Extension, which supports farmers, Sea Grant agents work with coastal communities, fishermen, and aquaculture operations on a number of issues, from beach erosion and ocean acidification to the development of new industries like sea vegetables and scallop ranching. It's the first time since the Reagan administration that the federal Sea Grant budget has been zeroed out. A Washington County Superior Court judge has ruled in favor of several shorefront property owners who maintain that rockweed, a form of seaweed, is not a resource that falls under the public trust. In his ruling, Justice Harold Stewart II concluded that rockweed growing in the intertidal zone is the property of the shorefront owner and should not be construed to be included under exemptions that include fishing, A.J. Higgins explains.
The case before Justice Stewart sought clarity on the question of who owns rockweed in Maine and pitted Washington County landowners against Acadian Sea Plants Limited, one of the largest processors of seaweed products in the world. Gordon Smith, a Portland attorney, represents the landowners in the case, and he says his clients were understandably pleased with the results.
The plaintiffs are very happy with the decision, not only because it was a pretty comprehensive victory on their behalf, but because the judge really took a lot of time and effort to dig into the legal issues. He did a very thorough review of all the precedent involved, and on the basis of that, he arrived at what we think is the compelling decision that the rockweed is owned by the intertidal landowner.
Smith says he fully expects the case to be appealed to the Maine Supreme Court. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
In his budget proposal released earlier this year, Governor Paul LePage vowed to drastically transform how schools are funded. The most notable change was the removal of roughly $40 million that the state gives local districts to help pay the salaries of administrators. Robbie Feinberg reports on how those cuts are affecting the plans of districts across the state.
In his State of the State address, Governor LePage hammered home the point that he thinks there are far too many administrators in Maine schools. Most notably, he pointed to the more than 100 school superintendents across the state.
We are the biggest outlier in the country when it comes to superintendents. We are just out of control.
Among many changes, LePage's new budget would remove all state money for those administrators, about $40 million. The new funding formula would boost allocations for some districts. Lewiston, for example, would receive an additional $4 million, and districts in Wells and Kittery would see at least another $100,000. However, other districts are looking at deficits that have them worried.
That's the tipping point. There's a point where you just can't do it with what you've got.
Mary Nash is the superintendent of MSAD 35, which covers the towns of Elliott and South Berwick. Under the new budget plan, Nash says her district is looking at a loss of more than $750,000 in state funds. Nash says the district would have to cut teachers and increase class sizes across every grade in order to balance its books. Nash says she understands that the governor wants to decrease administrative costs and direct more money money towards student instruction. But she says his plan would likely wind up hurting students in her district instead.
That these cuts are so significant, I said I wanted to make it very, very clear. They will impact every single one of our students next year. There's no question. And that's what's at stake for us.
In RSU 18 in the Belgrade Lakes region, Superintendent Gary Smith is looking at similar losses.
We're getting too good at cutting in each year, and this year is no different.
Smith says for the past 8 years, his district's budget has increased by only about 2%. But this year, he expects to reduce the staff by the equivalent of 5.5 positions. On top of that, Smith says he's asking local voters to put up extra money this year to help cover losses from the state. But he's unsure how much more they will agree to pay in property taxes.
So I expect some very good questioning about a 3.25% budget increase.
While the cuts in these districts are severe, they aren't set in stone. The legislature will continue to debate the budget over the next few months. Earlier this month, dozens of educators packed a budget hearing to testify against the proposal. Many were critical of the fact that the plan ignores a referendum approved this past fall that boosts education funding through a surtax on wealthier households. Ultimately, school officials say they are optimistic that the legislature will include more funding for education in its final budget. But in the meantime, they have to be prepared. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
When faced with a terminal illness, some people might choose to fight it. But increasingly, doctors and patients are taking a different tack. Instead of creating a battle plan that focuses on the illness, they create an approach that emphasizes patient goals. This attention to quality of life is called palliative care, or in the final stages of an illness, hospice. As part of our series on aging in this life, Patty White traveled to Damariscotta to visit a doctor and his patients as they navigate their final days.
At least once a week, Dr. Rob Hunold practices medicine the old-fashioned way. He makes house calls. Hunold is a family medicine doctor at Lincoln Health in Damariscotta. He's also the medical director of hospice. His first stop on this day is to see 87-year-old Bill Pierce.
Who has been to my house several times. He likes to deliver gifts, and he makes things like crafts, and he always likes to come over and bring it to my house. And unfortunately, he came into the emergency room about 6 months ago with a cough and was diagnosed with a large mass in his lung. And so he is dying, and we are helping him stay home with hospice services.
Hi. How are you doing?
Pierce sits in a big comfy chair. Blankets cover his lap and his shoulders. The purpose of Hunold's visit is not only to check on Pierce's physical health.
Bill, can I listen to your heart and lungs? Give me some deep breaths.
He's also here to check on Pierce's goal to stay at home, to see if it's still what he wants and if it's still possible.
I am a little worried about you, Bill. You don't look very good today.
Just growing old, that's all. People around me treat me pretty good.
Pierce's wife is here. So is his daughter, who's worried because her mom is exhausted from caring for Bill around the clock. Other family members step in where they can, but they don't live close by. The question in the room is whether the family can still manage to care for Bill at home. As a hospice physician, Dr. Hunold walks a fine line to balance the needs of the family with those of his patient.
I definitely think that we need to basically come on with everything we can think of to keep him comfortable and keep him here. And, I think we're getting close here. I think we're approaching end of life. I want to do everything I can and everything I can do to support the family to keep you here, because that's what you asked for at the beginning of all this, right?
Yeah.
And so I know it's stressful, and I know there's lots of moving pieces, but I guess I would encourage you to try to do what we can do. I mean, I'm not saying that we need to do that for the next 6 months. I'm thinking we need to do that for the next several weeks. I think that's your time.
As the reality of the situation sets in, Pierce's wife, Jeanette, starts to cry.
None of us can live forever, I guess. And you've got to accept it. And I'm trying.
Jeanette says having her husband here in his final days, in the house they've lived in for more than half a century, means everything.
We've been together 58 years, and I just want him home with me. We've had a good life, and I know he can't get better, and I don't want him to suffer, but I'd like to have him stay here with me as long as possible. I'm being selfish, maybe, but I'm being honest.
But Bill wants to be home, too. To continue to meet that goal, Hunold says he can bump up the hours of a nursing assistant who visits the family. He'll also look for volunteers to help. This chance to make Pierce's life better in the face of a terminal diagnosis is what drew Hunold to hospice care. He says he realized this calling as a young resident after watching patients die in a hospital emergency room. At first, he found it exciting to respond to patients who, in medical lingo, coded and were in cardiac distress.
But it never worked. And we were doing CPR on people who obviously weren't going to survive. These were, you know, old, sick people. And we had one code where I just think, you know, what we did felt so bad that I remember walking out and I went to my medical director for the residency. And I said, I'm not quite sure this is for me. I don't really like doing this anymore. I don't, you know, these codes and what we're doing to people. And he said, well, you want to experience a different way of dying? I said, yeah, I want to see people die differently.
Even though providing hospice care means bearing witness to heartbreaking goodbyes, Hunold says for him, the experiences reinforce the value of a life well spent.
Bill did something right, right? He's got a wife of, I don't know, 60-something years. He's got a daughter who is willing to take care of her father. He did something right.
You hang in there, Jeanette. Thank you, okay, for what you do.
1 week after Dr. Hunold's visit, Bill Pierce died. He was at home with his family at his side, Hunold says, holding his wife's hand to his face. It was the life he wanted. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
And Maine Public Radio's series In This Life is made possible by a grant from the Dorie Taylor Charitable Foundation. For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Thursday, March 16th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.